The headlines, former Mossad chief admits that the Israeli regime is enforcing an apartheid system in the occupied Palestinian territories. The Iranian president slams the military presence of extra-regional countries as the root cause of insecurity and terror in West Asia. And Russia condemns the U.S.'s plan to provide Ukraine with depleted uranium ammunition as a clear sign of inhumanity. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour, former head of Israel's spy agency Mossad admits that the regime is enforcing an apartheid system on the occupied West Bank.
Let's say there is a car accident between a car of a Jewish settler and a car of a Palestinian who lives in Hebron or Nablus. Each one of them stands before a different legal system, one under the military legal system and the other the civilian system. In a territory where two people are judged under two legal systems, that's an apartheid state.
Imparta warned that the greatest catastrophe awaits Israel as it's reaching a place similar to South Africa, a reference to an apartheid regime there. He becomes the latest former senior official to highlight that the regime's treatment of Palestinians amounts to apartheid. Pardo served as Mossad chief from 2011 to 2016. In the past, other retired officials warned about Israel's becoming an apartheid regime. However, Pardo's comments seem more frank and are akin to accusations by international and Israeli rights groups. They argue that Israel gives Palestinians a second-class status in order to uphold the hegemony of Zionists. Correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, joined us earlier to give us more on the apartheid system of the Israeli regime.
It's not the first time when Israeli officials say and accuse Israel of being unfair and treat the Palestinians in inhumane way. However, maybe it's that the language of this Israeli former chief of the Mossad is maybe strong, not like the language that had been used by former Israeli officials. The question that should be asked, and many Palestinians continue to ask, why, while those Israeli officials are in office, they do not accuse their authorities and the Israeli regime of treating the Palestinians and for committing crimes against the Palestinians? And many experts are asking, would it be while he was in office, would he say the same statements and remarks? Of course not. He knows that he's not in charge of anything anymore. And many Israeli military officials, Israeli soldiers themselves, when they leave being a member of any of the Israeli, whether military or civil organizations, they know very well that the Israeli regime and the Israeli military commit crimes. And Samir has said, that the Israeli regime literally is enforcing an apartheid system in the occupied West Bank.
The United Nations has demanded a probe into the forced stripping of five Palestinian women by Israeli soldiers during a raid in the occupied West Bank. UN Deputy Spokesperson Farhan Haq underlined that the case should be examined and investigated thoroughly. He said the UN stands against any form of collective punishment. The Organization of Islamic Cooperation also condemned the assault, urging international bodies to put pressure on Israel to end its daily breaches of human rights in Palestine. In July, Israeli media reported that five Palestinian women were forced to strip in front of their children and asked to walk around naked during a raid into a home in Al-Khalil. Israeli soldiers threatened to unleash the attack dogs if they did not comply with the order. According to Israeli rights group B'Tselem, evidence of women being stripped and at gunpoint by Israeli forces has escalated in recent months. The Iranian president says the presence of foreigners in West Asia does not help solve regional people's problems, but adds to their maladies. Ebrahim Raisi made the remark in an address to a large group of people in an eastern Iranian city. He added that 20 years of U.S. presence in Iraq and Afghanistan had no other outcome but war, bloodletting, and plundering of their wealth. Raisi noted that while Iran is bolstering security across the region, foreign presence only leads to insecurity and terror. The Iranian president stressed that it's time for foreign countries to leave and let regional states take control. He said withdrawal of foreigners is the best solution to the existing problems. Millions of Muslims from around the world have marked Arba'in, the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the third Shia Imam and the grandson of Prophet Muhammad. Our correspondent Gisu Mishamadi reports from the Esplanade, joining the two holy shrines of the city where pilgrims converged.
The golden-domed holy shrines of the Iraqi city of Karbala, once again hosting millions of lovers of Imam Hussein, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, and the third Shia Imam. Pilgrims dressed in black, some sporting headbands or carrying flags, bearing religious messages, expressed their sorrow, weeping and reciting eulogies in memory of Imam Hussein while moving forward shoulder to shoulder to enter the holy shrine of Imam Hussein and the shrine of his half-brother, Abul Fadl al-Abbas, passing through the esplanade joining the two shrines called Bayn al-Haramain. Streets leading to the holy shrines jam-packed with pilgrims hoping to get a chance to enter the holy site as crowds move in and out, taking turns to participate in the morning ceremonies of Arba'in, the largest annual religious gathering in the world. The event this year brought together over 22 million pilgrims from across the borders, including over 4 million Iranians, as well as millions of Iraqi people from other cities across the country. The pilgrimage reached its climax on Wednesday, but the faithful had already been converging for several days on Karbala, trying to get there the night before Arba'in to take part in special morning ceremonies. But the actual journey starts quite far from here. It starts on foot and days before Arba'in from the city of Najaf. The road from Najaf to Karbala is 80 kilometers long. Pilgrims were welcomed and served this year by 13,000 mukebs, makeshift tents that offer everything that pilgrims may need during the journey for free, including food, drinks, accommodation, and healthcare services.
Imam Hussein fought against oppression, and we come here every year to remember that.
Coming to Karbala for this occasion is a tradition that we have to uphold because of our love for Imam Hussein.
Imam Hussein is all we have. That is why we take this journey, and Iraqi people are very hospitable.
It's my first time here. I'm 15 years old, so it's a bit tiring. But overall, the hospitality here is great, the food here is lovely, and the people that take care of you, they ask you to come to their homes, give you food, and I'm loving the experience right now.
And with pilgrims coming from across the world to take part in this annual commemoration, more than anything, Arba'in is a show of solidarity among Muslims. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Karbala.
Elsewhere, Russia has denounced a U.S. plan to provide Ukraine with arms containing depleted uranium, calling it a clear sign of inhumanity. Russia's embassy in Washington said the U.S. is, quote, prepared to fight not only to the last Ukrainian, but also to do away with entire generations. It added that the United States deliberately transfers weapons with indiscriminate effects to Ukraine, but the Russian army will continue to methodically grind them. Earlier on Wednesday, the United States said it's sending depleted uranium ammunition to Kiev. That's part of a new arms package worth up to $1 billion. It also includes anti-tank missiles, artillery and mortar rounds, tactical air navigation systems, and ammunition for air defense systems. People in NATO and EU member Bulgaria have held a rally against the country's military support for Ukraine in its war with Russia.
Stupka, step by step, they continue to push Bulgaria on the path of war. Now we are handing over our armored personal carriers and all other things that are kept secret. Even the fact that Bulgarian groups are being prepared to participate in military missions to be included in the military actions of Ukrainian territory.
The March of Peace rally took place in the capital, Sofia, on the country's Unification Day. Protesters held flags and banners reading messages such as Bulgaria, a zone of peace, and referendum for peace and sovereignty. In July, the Bulgarian government sent a large military aid package to Ukraine. This marked the country's first official decision to support Kiev in the war with Russia. Western countries have been providing Ukraine with advanced and sophisticated arms since the war broke out in February last year. However, surveys show that public support for military and financial assistance to Kiev is in decline across the West. Moscow has warned that the military aid will only prolong the conflict and the suffering of Ukrainians. Armenia will hold joint military drills with the United States despite concerns among regional countries, including Russia. Armenia's defense ministry says the exercises dubbed Eagle Partner 2023 will last 10 days starting from September 11th. According to the ministry, the drills are aimed at increasing the level of interoperability of the units participating in international peacekeeping missions. Russia has expressed concern over the upcoming war games. The Kremlin spokesman also criticized Armenia's Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan for his remarks that the country's decades-long alliance with Russia could be deemed a, quote, strategic mistake. The drills are the first of their kind amid mounting tensions between Armenia and Azerbaijan over the Nagorno-Karabakh region. World leaders have gathered in the Indonesian capital, Jakarta, for the East Asia Summit amid rising tensions between the U.S. and China on a host of issues. The East Asia Summit comprises 18 countries, including 10 members of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN. The summit is the foremost of the ASEAN-centered mechanisms in the Indo-Pacific. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris and Chinese Prime Minister Li Qiang and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov are in attendance, along with the leaders of Japan, South Korea, India, Australia, and others. On Wednesday, China's Li warned against a new Cold War and countries taking sides in any conflict. The U.S. and China have already traded accusations of destabilizing the Southeast Asian region. A group of Australian lawmakers has planned to visit the United States later this month to demand an end to Washington's push to get WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange extradited to the country. The U.S. has been seeking the extradition of Assange, an Australian citizen, after his whistleblower website published thousands of U.S. government documents, including those related to war crimes in Afghanistan and Iraq.
A group of Australian lawmakers are set to travel to the United States this month to push for the release of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. The cross-party delegation includes former Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce, who said in a news conference on Tuesday, enough is enough.
It's incredibly important that we use this opportunity to convey to the United States, as even as a very strong ally, that the issue pertinent to Mr. Assange should be coming to a conclusion. Enough is enough. He's been incarcerated now for a long period of time.
The Australian delegation is scheduled to travel to the U.S. ahead of a visit by Prime Minister Anthony Albanese to the White House in October. Six Australian politicians are expected to focus on freedom of speech arguments when they fly to Washington, D.C. to warn against extraditing the WikiLeaks founder from the U.K.
People of the United States feel strongly about their First Amendment rights to free speech and to freedom of the press, and Australians feel the same way. Australia is an excellent friend to the US, and it's not an unreasonable request to ask the US to cease this extradition attempt on Mr. Assange. He is a journalist.
The delegation is expected to meet members of the U.S. Congress and Senate, along with officials at the State and Justice Departments, as well as think tanks, American Civil Liberties Union, and Reporters Without Borders. The multi-party delegation will urge U.S. leaders to abandon their efforts to have Assange, who is an Australian citizen, extradited to the U.S. to face 18 charges, 17 charges of espionage and one charge of computer misuse, related to the publication of thousands of military and diplomatic documents revealing U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan and Iraq on his whistleblower website, If convicted, Assange could face up to 2 life sentences in jail. U.S. prosecutors allege Assange helped U.S. Army intelligence analyst Chelsea Manning steal classified diplomatic cables and military files that WikiLeaks later published, putting U.S. servicemen's lives at risk. However, Assange's supporters say the WikiLeaks founder is being victimized for exposing wrongdoings by the U.S.
Assange is praised worldwide as an anti-establishment hero who's been targeted by the West in a politically motivated assault on journalism and free speech. The majority of Australians believe the pursuit of the WikiLeaks founder should come to an end.
Greg Barnes, a human rights lawyer and campaign advisor for Assange, said the majority of Australians believe the pursuit of the WikiLeaks founder should come to an end. He said that can only happen if the U.S. Department of Justice drops its extradition bid at once. Assange says he merely engaged in investigative journalistic activities that are legal in the U.S. and that accusations of him conspiring to hack the Pentagon's computer systems were false. He and his supporters believe the accusations are politically motivated and represent an unprecedented attack on press freedom and the public's right to know, seeking to criminalize basic journalistic activity. Late legendary American whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, who leaked the Pentagon Papers in 1971 that laid bare U.S. deceit and lies about the Vietnam War, had blasted the U.S. for its push for extraditing Assange, calling it a blatant violation of press freedom.
When there hasn't actually been such a significant attack on the freedom of the press, the First Amendment, which is the bedrock of our republic, really, our form of government, since my case in 1971, 48 years ago. But this is, I was indicted as a source. And I warned newsmen then that that would not be the last indictment of a source if I were convicted. Well, I wasn't convicted. The charges were dropped on governmental misconduct. And it was another 10 years before anybody else faced that charge under the Espionage Act again, Samuel Loring Morrison. And it was not until President Obama that 9 cases were brought, as I'd been warning for so long. But my warning really was that it wasn't going to stop there. Almost inevitably, there would be a stronger attack directly on the foundations of journalism against editors, publishers, and journalists themselves. And we've now seen that as of yesterday. That's a new front in President Trump's war on the free press, which he regards as the enemy of the people. They're not supposed to extradite for political offenses or for political motives, and this is obviously for both political motives and political offenses.
Whistleblowing website WikiLeaks has earned an international reputation for disclosing secret documents from governments around the world. Since it was founded in 2006, it has published hundreds of thousands of secret files and diplomatic cables. But the nonprofit media organization owes the bulk of its global prominence to leaking U.S. diplomatic cables that revealed the extent of corruption, horrifying killings, and abuse of civilians by U.S. forces in Iraq and Afghanistan. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has come to be known as the face of the whistleblowing NGO, and obviously, he is detested by many governments.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The dollarization process is gaining momentum, as BRICS officials say. Recently, Russian Foreign Ministry spokesperson said, "The dollarization is not simply an aim pursued by Russia, but has become a global reality. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more." According to RT, Maria Zakharova, Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman, in an interview with the Turkish news outlet Aydin Lik, published recently, said, "Ever more countries are turning to national currencies for trade rather than the use of the dollar, which has become a very problematic means of payment." According to Zakharova, the U.S. initially proposed the dollar as an international currency to make everyone's life better, easier, more comfortable. They were very insistent on this, saying that it would bring the world economy to a new level and simplify our transactions and relationships. And at the time, those who made such a policy in the US and abroad probably wanted to take that first step towards globalization honestly. Now, according to Zakharova, the dollar is used to pressure Washington's political opponents. "What we faced last year is something completely different," she stated, referring to the numerous Western sanctions placed on Russia over the Ukraine conflict, including an effective ban on Russia using the dollar in international transactions. "There is no simplifying or making our lives easier. The currency is being used as a tool of hegemony and a new kind of colonialism used to punish, segregate, and make our lives a nightmare," she said. According to Zakharova, the process of de-dollarization, which Russia and a growing number of other countries have been pursuing in cross-border trade, is not a goal in and of itself, but a simple fact of reality. She said, "They say de-dollarization is a kind of ultimate goal of different organizations or some countries, but it is not. This is not our target. This is just a reality. The dollar is a very problematic currency these days. This is not my political view. It is an objective economic fact." Zakharova noted that most global economic problems originate in the U.S., including the 2008 global economic crisis. National currencies, on the other hand, are more stable, which is why an increasing number of countries are opting for them, she believes. The official said, "They want to establish and create a kind of a guarantee, a financial guarantee system, in order not to once again be a victim of an American crisis. It is up to the currencies to decide how to do it. But as I understand it, more and more countries want to do something to avoid becoming another victim of the American financial system." Russia has been reducing the use of the U.S. dollar in foreign trade since 2014, but last year's sanctions forced the country to step up these efforts. For instance, the share of national and friendly currencies in the country's trade with the Eurasian Economic Union grew to nearly 80% in 2022 and is expected to reach 90% by the end of this year. Recently, reports emerged that the BRICS group of emerging economies, which presently comprises Russia, Brazil, India, China, and South Africa, but is due to add 6 new members next year, is also considering switching all cross-border trade to national currencies. According to South China Morning Post, expansion rate of the Brazil, Russia, India, China and South Africa economic bloc, or the BRICS, seen determining speed at which it stops using U.S. dollar systems to help ward off Washington's alleged currency weaponization, calls to shift away from the U.S. dollar are growing louder. The Association of 5 Major Emerging National Economies, including Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, represents about a quarter of the global economy and accounts for 41.9% of people on Earth. Bloc representatives met in South Africa, Johannesburg, recently.
Out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The shadow war between Israel and Iran has been ongoing for decades. Just recently, Iran foiled one of the biggest military sabotage attempts against it in the past 100 years. It involved an Israeli plot to sabotage Iran's defense industry, including its missile systems. Iran has accused the Israeli Mossad agency, although Israel has not admitted to this terrorist act. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the number of times that Israel has committed acts of terrorism against Iran, resulting in death and destruction, and how it yet still continues to act with impunity in the face of the silence of the international community. First, let me introduce our guests. Saab Shahat, author and West Asia expert, joins us from Belfast. Also joining us, Jamal Wakim, professor of international relations at the Lebanese University, who joins us from Beirut. Welcome to you both. Saab Shahat, over to you. I had to read over the details of this sabotage attack a number of times in order to get the depth of the type of destruction that this would have incurred, based on what we have, defective parts into the production of advanced missiles, specifically defective connections or connectors from abroad. But what Iran's deputy defense minister said is quite not only alarming but eye-opening, that they had attempted, Israel's Mossad agency, to put an explosive and undetectable circuit inside these missiles. So if these missiles have something that blows up, I'm guessing the missile itself is going to blow up, and that would cause not only destruction but also deaths. What's your reading into how long this was probably in the works and the fact that Iran defeated this terrorist act?
This is a very sophisticated network was deployed by the Mossad and its needs Western intelligence agency to help them that. Because that means they need to infiltrate the chain of supplies in here, and most countries in the world, even the United States of America, is not sufficient enough locally for minerals or parts to produce all the necessary parts for its own military equipment to stay ahead of the rest. We noticed the United States of America for minerals and other rare materials, they depend heavily on country like China. So we expect in Iran, which is nearly after the Iranian Revolution, developed itself heavily under even the sanctions and the blockades after the revolution. Iran today, which used to be heavily before the revolution, dependent on Western and United States of America's wide kind of military supplies. Today, 90% Iran is self-sufficient, and the 10% which is needed parts or elements buys from the outside. There, where is the plug-in, the intelligence services try to reach and to plug in its own agents inside so they can infiltrate the civilian and military infrastructure inside Iran. As rightly you said, they don't care if they're gonna when the missile system explodes. They don't care about the civilians' lives or that, because it's in their habit from the beginning. They were assassinating some of the brightest minds in Iran, scientists in universities or experts in military or in civilian fields. So this is part of them in weakening this state who became independent since 1979.
All right. So Jamal Wakim, not only were the missiles targeted, we also have the fact that these parts could be also used in Iran's drones. All right, yeah. So we're looking at missiles and drones to have been their focus. Now, Iran has had missiles and drones for quite some time. Why do you think that Israel has chosen this time for them to execute this terrorist act in targeting Iran's drones and missiles missile capabilities?
Well, actually, Israel's targeting of Iran's capabilities, especially the missile and the drone capabilities, isn't something new. They have been trying to curtail all efforts by Iran to develop its defense systems. And lately, Iran has become very developed on the technological level in manufacturing these drones and missiles, which have become also part of the arsenal of the axis of resistance, including the resistance movement in Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and Palestine. So that's why the Israeli Mossad is trying to target these capabilities, regardless of the victims that might fall or the casualties that might fall victim of such acts, even if they were civilians. This is not the first time that the Israelis do that. It has been part of their strategy and of their tactics to curb the attempts of certain Arab and Islamic powers to develop their own capabilities in order to defend themselves against Israeli aggression. If we go back to the 1960s, we see how the Israelis have targeted, for example, the missile program in Egypt back then, and how they exploded several explosives in Egypt to target German scientists who have been working in developing, for example, the missile system and the nuclear capabilities of Egypt during the days of Nasser. Later on, they did the same, for example, in Iraq when they targeted the nuclear facility in Iraq in the early 1980s. After the invasion of Iraq by the United States, the Israelis and the Americans have targeted the Iraqi scientists, for example. Thousands of them were assassinated without the media mentioning this. And of course, they have been doing the same thing with Iran over the past 40 years, because this has been a continuous effort by the Israelis and the Americans, of course, to damage Iran's attempts to defend itself, to develop its own defense system, and to rely on itself and not on others to sustain an independent political option and its sovereignty, right, of course.
Well, I'm just wondering, with all that you said, which is, thank you so much for putting up the rap sheet by what I would understand if I was not even slightly aware of any of this, that you have an entity that has a rap sheet that that runs like somebody who should be in prison. I mean, what gives Iran what gives Israel the right, Slavshath, for it to have, from what we understand, an industry defined in the Mossad configuration to go and target assassinations, bombs, what have you, based on what our guest there said?
You see, it all goes to the Islamic Revolution in Iran. Before the Islamic Revolution, Iran used to be a country which is, its resources don't belong to the people of Iran. The resources were belong to the imperialist entities, which is the United States, and before that, even the United Kingdom, Britain. Once I said in a kind of conference in a university in England, a figure, and I said, I challenge anybody to prove me wrong. After the Second World War, the British used nearly 40% of their budget to rebuild Britain after the destruction which is inflicted in it by the Nazi Germany. Only 40% of that came from one country, from Iran. You can understand how much they lost. And the United States of America, after that, they see Iran was the jewel of the crown which they lost. And all of that, they try today, they do their best to do a change regime to whatever, to bring that country, which is full of resources and talent as well, back to their hegemony. So this is the way the West lives and progress. An entity like Israel, it's a function state. And that function state is in there as advanced military base for the United States of America and the Western countries to use for their interest. The interest in here, the resources, and the control of the area. And that is the target of Israel. And Israel will always, to survive, have to serve their masters as it's what is required from them. They require from Israel, by the United States of America and the rest, to destabilize Iran, to create havoc in Iran, to make sure the people try to revolt against the system. Such a thing, it is a duty of the Zionist entity linked to it and attached to it, I mean, by the United States of America.
Well, what you have over here, Slavshath, is the pretext that Israel has used in terms of the different terrorist campaigns that it has executed against Iran on the premise that they need to stop Iran's, what it is, a civilian nuclear program, which Israel claims is an Iranian weapons program in the nuclear arena. But isn't it quite ironic that Israel is not the signatory of the NPT, possesses nuclear weapons, and yet accuses Iran of going after nuclear weapons and uses that as its premise to attack Iran in different terrorist activities?
The more ridiculous is that.
This is for Slavshath. If you have, I'm sorry. This is for Jamal Wakim. I'm sorry about that, Slavshath. Jamal Wakim, go ahead.
I got confused. Can you repeat the question?
The gist of my question is, ironic that Israel, who is armed with nuclear weapons, is using that premise against Iran, who not only has a civilian nuclear program, has also called for a West Asia region free of nuclear weapons, and has a civilian nuclear nuclear program, yet Israel accuses it of it being weaponized.
Yeah, actually, Israel fears that the Arabs and Muslim countries build their own capabilities, even if they were civil capabilities. Well, if we go back to the early 1950s, when Nasser led his coup d'etat in 1952 and took over power, all he had in mind was to build the economy of Egypt. So, and this is what he told to the American envoy at the time who came on peace proposal. So this American envoy went to Ben-Gurion, the founder of the Zionist entity, and told him that Nasser wants to focus more on internal economic development. And this is when Ben-Gurion said, this is what worries me most. Actually, Israel doesn't want for the Arab and Muslim countries and also third world countries to build their own capabilities, for it is a tool, as your guest said, it's a tool in the hands of the imperialist Western powers to dominate the non-Western world, especially the Arab Muslim world. So in order to dominate the, these countries, they want to forbid them and prevent them from building their own capabilities, economic, technological, and of course, armed capabilities. So that's why, for example, Israel, that has hundreds of nuclear warheads, and that have declared on several occasions that is willing, it's willing to use these capabilities against its quote-unquote enemies, is targeting, for example, the civilian nuclear program in Iran. This is what it did, for example, with also other capabilities. For example, this is the reason why they assassinated Iraqi scientists who were working in civilian sectors, in various civilian sectors, including the medical sector.
Sure.
So Israel wants to, and this is what it did also with Iraqi scientists, not only working in the military field or the in the nuclear program, but also in other sectors and programs. So Israel wants to keep these countries underdeveloped. They want to keep these countries weak in order for these countries to remain under the Western hegemony.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
So, Sapshath, how is Israel doing at this point? We're looking at what, over four decades with Jamal Waqim, clearly outlined all these different ways and terrorist, acts to prevent countries from advancing. I can talk on behalf of Iran, and we can see how Iran is reaching its almost full potential when it comes to missiles, when it comes to drones, when it comes to its nuclear program. So, all these different ways that Israel tried to prevent Iran from advancing hasn't really worked that much. Why does Israel keep pursuing a failed plan?
You see, in the 90s, the Americans convinced, when there was collapse of the Soviet Union, a lot of corrupt Russians in the Soviet military complex to let a lot of these scientists immigrate to the Zionist entity undercover of, at the time, what Gorbachev said, allowing the Jewish people, Russian Jews, to go to the Israel. And lots of these capabilities which developed inside Israel were Soviet military complex, which the Americans managed to shift most of it after the collapse of the Soviet Union over there. That's part of it. But when you see, on the other hand, as you're alluding to Iran, the progress made in Iran after the sanctions, the blockades, the war imposed on Iran 8 years, Iran have to develop itself. It's, you know, like live or die. And this were developed capabilities. Like, I'll give you an example. Today, Iran developed capabilities to intercept targets cutting edge, like we're talking about the U.S.-made F-35 fighter jet. This capabilities is there today. The Iranian scientists developed that to detect and target and intercept such powerful and cutting-edge fighter jets. Sure. Today, the Iranian drones, okay, they are wanted by the Europeans themselves. They're seeking to buy them because they saw what is done in the Ukraine. So Israel wants, Israel finds itself going downhill. Israel developed by the American military complex and Western military complex, adding to the Soviet Union military complex.
Okay. First of all, Iran's official stance is that it does not and has not sold drones to Russia, but that's a whole other point, but I figured I should say that. All right, so the U.S. involvement here, Sobshoth, both of you have mentioned one way or another that it is involved. One thing for sure is the Stuxnet virus, where it was proven that both the U.S. and Israel Intel Services worked together to create that. How deep is the U.S. involvement when it comes to Israeli terrorist activities? Do you think that Israel actually seeks for U.S. Approval when it goes ahead, seeks U.S. cooperation, or the level and the extent of U.S. involvement, in your opinion here? Not Sobshoth. I'm sorry, Jamal Wakim.
Well, first of all, we need to understand the fact that Israel acts as an extension of the United States. Of course, there are times of lack of coordination, but this entail details. But when it comes to the grand strategy, Israel is an extension of the United States and acts within the framework of the U.S. Strategy. That's why we need first to see why the United States wants to target the Iranian capabilities, because the United States is an imperialist power. It doesn't want for other powers to build their own defenses, their own capabilities, in order for it to be capable of dominating or extending its hegemony over these countries. That's one thing. And if we go back to the early 1950s, when this is the reason why, for example, it engineered the coup d'etat against the Prime Minister Mossadegh back then. So if we understand the U.S. policy, especially towards Iran, they want to control the Middle East, as which is the region stretching from the Atlantic Ocean in the west all the way to the borders of China in the east, as part of their plan, of the U.S. plan, to control the crossroads of international trade routes in the world. And controlling this region will also block the Eurasian powers from having access to the East Mediterranean and to Africa. And this is the reason why they keep trying to destroy Iran, to topple the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic in Iran, because it has been standing against U.S. Hegemony and standing for its own sovereignty.
Sobshoth, final question to you, and it's probably one of the most important ones. This is what a former Iranian ambassador to the IAEA has said. Quote, not only will we respond decisively, but we will also certainly leave no option for Iran but to reconsider its transparency measures and cooperation policy. When do you think Israel is going to cross that red line where Iran is going to think, all right, that's it, it's one too many?
You see, Israel, it cannot act whatsoever. I confirm what Joaquin was saying there. Israel is an extension of the United States of America's army. Israel, to me, is part of the deep state in the United States of America. And whatever Israel acts, it has to be part of the United States of America's policy. The United States of America, if it sees the Iranian nuclear project, civil a nuclear project in there, as a threat to the American national interest, then the Israel will act on behalf of the national United States national interest. Israel will not act in any other way, even if the United States of America see that is endangering the existence of the Zionist entity itself. But the Americans doesn't want them to act; they will not act.
All right, thank you so much. We're going to have to end it there because of lack of time. Saab Shath, author and West Asia expert from Belfast. Thank you so much. And Jamal Wakim, professor of international relations at the Lebanese University from Beirut. Thank you. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Vitale and the team. It's goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intel Sat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Al-Naqi means the pure, the immaculate, the clean. Al-Hadi means the guide. All the Imams came for guidance.
As-salamu alaykum ya ahla bayt al-nubuwa wa mawdi'a al-risala wa mukhtalaf al-malaki.
Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety.
This is Dialogue, an introduction into the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam. Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam was this beautiful fountainhead of wisdom and knowledge. He had complete mastery over all of the Islamic sciences, but he was also a master upon the non-Islamic sciences. He was the honorable direct descendant of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him. And His Eminence Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was the 10th divinely appointed Imam, the 10th divinely appointed successor, and the 10th divinely appointed trustee of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. During the imama of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, the Abbasid Caliph Mutawakkil had the most bitter enmity against Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, and this was due to the special respect and honor that was given to Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam. Mutawakkil Abbasi imposed a severe house arrest upon the 10th divinely appointed Imam. He monitored all his activities, he pinpointed his followers, and prevented legal dues from coming to Imam al-Hadi. He even tried his best to prevent scholars and narrators from associating with the divinely appointed Imam. Unfortunately, Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam suffered a lot during the reign of Mutawakkil Abbasi.
Parts of Ziyara text of Jamaatul Kabira issued by Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam.
Bismillahi ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As-salamu ala a'immat al-huda wa masabih al-tuja wa a'lam al-tuqa wa dawinuha.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety, the owners of understanding, the endued with thought, the havens of the peoples, the inheritors of the prophets, the perfect specimen, the most excellent call, and the arguments of Allah against the inhabitants of the world, the hereafter and the former world. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon you all.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. As-salamu ala mahal.
Peace be upon the exponents of the recognition of Allah, the centers of Allah's blessing, the essence of Allah's wisdom, the keepers of Allah's secrets, the bearers of Allah's book, the successor of Allah's Prophet, and the progeny of Allah's Messenger. May Allah send blessings upon him and his household. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon them.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about the dialogues and the conversations of the 10th divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam. Now, one of these interesting conversations that we have dealt with a little bit on prior episodes is this conversation that Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam has with his companions after a group of pseudo-Sufis and these pseudo-pious people enter the masjid. They go to the corner of the masjid and they start singing and do these incantations of La ilaha illallah. There is no God but Allah. And now, in response to these actions of and these incantations of these Sufis, we find that Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam turns towards his companions and he says some things which, were to the effect of that they must be very careful of these individuals and that they are actually deceivers and they are the allies of the shayateen. And they are the people that are destroying the bases and the roots and the foundations of the religion.